Public.com has just launched its new high-yield cash account, offering an industry-leading 5.1% APY. No fees, no subscriptions, and no minimums or maximums. That means you can grow your cash with 5.1% interest with no strings attached. It's as simple as that. Again, that's 5.1% interest with no fees, 5.1% interest with no subscription, 5.1% interest with no minimums or maximums, 5.1% interest with up to $5 million FDIC insurance. Just 5.1% interest, straight up, no strings attached. Sign up today at public.com/JRO. This is a paid endorsement for public.com. 5.1% APY as of December 20th, 2023, and is subject to change. Full disclosures and terms and conditions can be found in the podcast description. High-yield cash accounts are available for U.S. members only.
Welcome to The J-Row Show. On this podcast, your host, John Rotondi, interviews experts in and outside the world of investing. The J-Row Show dives deep into what it takes to achieve mastery and sustain top-level performance. As a quick reminder, this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. All opinions expressed by John or any of his podcast guests are solely their own and do not constitute formal advice or a recommendation. Now, please enjoy this episode.
I'm John Rotondi, and this is The J-Row Show, a podcast that explores what it takes to achieve mastery, sustained performance, and longevity. The show hopes to uncover the processes, structures, frameworks, and mindsets that masters put in place to maintain winning performance in their respective fields. Today, I am joined by Todd Alston. Todd is the Chief Investment Officer at Parnassus, which has about $42 billion in assets under management. Todd is also lead portfolio manager of the Parnassus Core Equity Fund. Prior to this, he was the director of research at Parnassus. He is also a member of the exclusive Barron's Roundtable. The Parnassus Core Equity Institutional Class Fund has 5 stars and a gold rating from Morningstar. The fund has generated roughly 16% annualized returns over the last 5 years and nearly 12% annualized returns over the last 10. That's pretty great performance. Todd, welcome to the J-Row Show.
John, it's great to be here. I'm super excited for our conversation today.
Thank you, Todd. Why don't we start off? Just tell us about Parnassus Investments.
Well, Parnassus, John, is a really unique company in that our legacy is really passionate about, you know, finding stocks that we think can outperform over the long term in terms of looking for quality. We love digging into businesses. We love the dynamics of businesses in intrinsic value and growing earnings and cash flows. And so for us, when you think about Parnassus, we were founded by Jerry Dodson in 1984. And Jerry had a real vision that you could invest in businesses that not only, you know, were sustainable and how they treated the environment and treated their workers and were innovative, but were also good investments. So we were one of the initial companies that really thought about sustainability and investing. And what led to that were really our contrarian genes. We wanted to find good businesses that were undervalued, but there was some dynamic that was misunderstood or not fully thought through. And because of that, we're able to really find some good long-term winners over time.
Excellent introduction there. And how did you get started at Parnassus and then eventually become the Chief Investment Officer?
Yeah. So, John, it's a remarkable story that my dad was a pilot at TWA. And when your dad's an airline pilot, it's just super cool. You get to fly for free. And I became very attached to the airline. But in 1985, Carl Icahn came in and Carl looked at TWA and he thought, you know, this business is worth more in pieces than the whole. And so that really struck me when my dad came home and said, this guy is buying the airline and it's like buying a car for, you know, for $10,000 and selling the parts for $20,000. And so I was instantly mesmerized by that. And after basketball practice, my mom started dropping me off at the library and I started looking at S&P reports and value lines and all those things and say, how can someone buy a business and the pieces are worth more than the whole? I love baseball. I love games of chance. I loved odds. I love numbers. I would think about trades for my Oakland A's and, you know, what value do you get? How do you build a team? So all these things melded together that I was hooked to investing. And so that was really the backdrop of it. And then when I was going to Berkeley, I met, you know, Jerry through the intern program in 1994. And kind of the rest is history. I'm still here. I'm in my 29th year at Parnassus. And so it's been a real blessing. And I just love investing.
That was such a great origin story. I remember reading not too long ago, you put out a sort of semiconductor primer. And in that primer, you talked about all of the semiconductor cycles that you have lived through and invested through. And so you do have some great long-term experience there. What type of investor are you, Todd? What is your investing philosophy? Do you label yourself as a value investor or a growth investor? Are you an ESG investor? Or do you just prefer to avoid labels altogether?
Yeah, so we think about the world as if you really had to put myself in a box, it would be growth at a reasonable price. Mm-hmm. And because when you think about our process, we want to invest in companies that whatever they do, John, they have to be more relevant in the economy over 1, 3, 5, and 10 years. And so that relevancy is how you build intrinsic value. It's innovation, it's business models, it's growth, it's participating in economic activity. And if you're fundamentally not selling a product that's more relevant long-term, that's really tough to compound long-term value sustainably. So that's the first thing. So that gives us a growth dynamic. But then there's the moat part of it is that, you know, what are the barriers to entry? How do you have sustainable competitive advantage? So the essence of what we do here, John, is that you've got to have companies that are doing something more relevant sustainably, that's innovation, that's being dynamic, that's part of secular trends. But then if you don't have a sustainable moat, you can't get cash flows, returns on capital. And then if you happen to have recessions, those moats give you some downside protection to help you get pricing in inflationary periods. So the relevancy and the moat make us more in that GARP framework. But going back to the origin story, when I was 22 years old and joined the company, I had probably the most simple job description in the history of this business. Our founder, Jerry Dodson, said, just find stocks that go up. And I'm like, so Jerry, can you tell me one more time? Because all my friends that are going into investment banking and accounting, and they work at Goldman and they work at Morgan, they have like these this job descriptions. He's like, no, just find stocks that go up. And they typically go up for three reasons and go down for three reasons. So stay focused. And so back then, John, just to kind of clear the air here, we were founded before there was Morningstar style boxes. Okay. Sure. And so that's one of my legacies is that when I showed up at the company, no Morningstar style boxes, no cell phone, no internet, no computer, no podcasts, no email address. Go find stocks that go up. Okay. That's the world. That's mind-blowing for a lot of people on this podcast. But that is the beauty of, as a very young individual, getting to look at lots of different businesses. I saw broken value businesses. I saw growth businesses like, you know, Cisco Systems back in 1995. So because I got to look at everything, non-diversified, all style boxes, all cap ranges, I got to see a ton by the time I was 25 years old. And doing that in a period where there wasn't, you know, as much research bombarding you. You actually had to have some original thought and think things through. And so because of that, in the end, after a lot of learnings, I think I settled on growth at a reasonable price, but it wasn't after looking at probably every style box and a lot of different assets to finally hone in that's the place where I think you can generate alpha long term.
That is such a good story. You know, I've been an admirer of Parnassus for a long time. I published an interview with Jerry, your founder, back in 2016. I published a written interview with Ben Allen, your co-portfolio manager and also the CEO of Parnassus. And one of the things that was driven home to me is this emphasis y'all place on relevance of the product and the service. And that's what's going to drive long-term demand and growth of that product or service. And, you know, I can't think of a whole lot of other investing firms. And as you know, Todd, I study investing firms for a living. I can't think of another one that puts as much emphasis on relevance and then the moat as y'all do. That is one thing that I've taken away speaking to Jerry, speaking to Ben, speaking to you several times over the years. But the other thing that I love, you've already mentioned two other lessons you learned from Jerry. One is that good businesses, sustainable businesses, businesses that try to do good in the world, tend to outperform over time. And the other one was, Jerry said, just find stocks that go up. And there's usually three or four key drivers of what will make a stock go up. And he sort of drilled that into you, it sounds like, at a very early age. Look for those three key drivers.
Well, he totally did, John. And that's what's so precious about this is I think a lot of investors, they get emotional and temperament is so key. So what I learned as a 22, 23-year-old from Jerry was that at the end of the day, stocks move for a couple reasons.
Yep.
And because people are human and have emotions, they over-extrapolate. And so when it came to our process, John, the key thing is you have to have some sort of contrarian genes to outperform long-term. And so in the introduction, it's almost hard to frame all of it because Jerry in his kind of founding of the firm is a contrarian. And so when you're a contrarian, something in a business is going wrong short-term. And because of that, it's easy to over-extrapolate what's going wrong. But the relevance part is so key because, say, semiconductors, which has been so good to us over the years, you know long-term the business is going up and to the right.
Yep.
That's because of demand or new applications. Think about semiconductors going from PCs to handhelds to cloud computing to big data to AI to autonomous driving to all these things. You know that demand's up and to the right. But you have cycles around it. You have bullwhip over economics and inventories and product cycles and the economy and trade wars. So the beautiful thing for us is where you have a growth dynamic, which is relevancy, because that's how you sleep 8 hours a night, John, because you know where this, you pretty much know how the story is going to end. It might be timing of a quarter or two, but you have to have the temperament and the emotional stability to find those opportunities. And when people are seeing more of a negative story, to focus on where are we going to be 12, 18, 24, 36 months from now. And so the key thing on relevancy is what is the shelf life of the information you're processing? And in this 24/7 world we're in, people are over extrapolating short shelf life information. And I think that went all the way back to 1995, where to kind of sum all this up, you got to find a business that's innovating, that's dynamic, that has secular trends. And as long as that is true and there's a short-term setback, that's where that alpha generation is. And then ultimately you want beta. You want beta to winning ideas. And the beta also comes out of relevancy, right? And so alpha comes out of the short-term mislocation or the over-extrapolation of negatives. The beta is the long-term relevancy, right? And that's how you kind of get double action getting paid.
I love how you separate, you can win betting on both beta and finding alpha opportunities. Another thing that I think about, Todd, when I think Parnassus is what you just said, it's finding secular, long-term secular growers that also go through these cycles. And when you can buy those long-term secular growers, these companies that are powered by long-term, long duration tailwinds, but are temporarily knocked down because of the cycle, you can get that double whammy of long-term beta and the alpha opportunity. I think we touched on this because you mentioned contrarianism and you mentioned the right temperament, but are there any other qualities you think successful investors have above and beyond a contrarian gene and the right temperament?
You know, John, you always say, like, you know, going back to Steve Jobs, like think different, Apple. I think to be a successful investor, you have to find that place where you can really quiet your mind and take all the noise out there and really focus on the signal. And because of that, I mean, I've had the honor and humility to know quite a few great investors over the years. Yep. And one trait is they all have a different way, I think, of finding that place where they can process information and look long-term. And ultimately, the whole goal here is to try to see around corners, right? I mean, that's whatever you can do to increase those odds. And for me, there's some things that I have that are really valuable. I'm a runner. So I last year I keep a running journal every day where I run. So I ran 1,055 miles last year. Awesome. And that's a really great place. I don't run with music and I love podcasts. I love podcasts like yours, but
thank you.
In that run, for me, I need to quiet my mind. And I love 80s rock and classic rock and podcasts. But on that run, what I learned a long time ago is that there was a moment when I used to fly in airplanes. I still do a lot, where all of a sudden I was like, why am I getting so much work done on airplanes? The door closes, no internet, and you're sitting there in this most passive way possible. It's because I was bored for half an hour, frustrated. And then I found this magical place of creativity because there's no more distraction.
Yep.
So I run a lot. I am very dedicated to not having a lot of screen time. I pretty much only spend an hour a day on a computer. And you're wondering, how do you do it? Well, I'm an extrovert. I like drinking coffee. I talk to my team. I go on walks. I run. And what I find is too much screen time reduces your ability to process long shelf life information. So I'm different in that I run. Pretty much on Sunday, I'm all family. You can't really get a hold of me. You get a hold of my wife and she'll find me. It's frustrating. My friends, I basically have a web Sabbath on Sundays. In the evening, I'm up early, but like when I get home with my wife and kids, I coach basketball, I coach baseball from 6 o'clock to 9 p.m. I'm a dad. I have dinner. I'm doing sports. We play board games. You have to disconnect, because when you disconnect and come back on, sometimes things that are right in front of you emerge in front of your eyes. So I deeply think the digital world is incredible. It's awesome. People like yourself are doing invaluable service just to get people ideas. But the minute you listen to this podcast, go for a run, go for a walk, go get a good cup of coffee, because that's where the creativity comes in. And that's where you find the conviction, the long game, managing the stress, and all those things are really key.
I'm going to have to clip the Q&A from that answer right there. You know, you said too much screen time reduces your ability to analyze long shelf life information.
That's well said.
Well, I think that's one of my new favorite investing quotes of all time. So thank you for that. What types of businesses do you like to buy stock in? I mean, I know you mentioned moats and relevance. You know, with semiconductors, you mentioned the increase in use cases from just PCs to handhelds to now everything cloud and AI and everything else. But is there anything else beyond relevance and moats and long duration growth that you look for in a business?
Yeah, it's such a great point, because I think about the long-term game we've played in terms of investing and our passion for it. There's really two groups that I'd focus on there. The one is just the long-term quality compounder that is so good in terms of compounding a business where you can invest capital in it. And something like a Praxair or Linde, for example, right? When you think about Linde, we've owned the stock for over 20 years. Industrial gases are everywhere. They have basically monopolies around their over-the-fence operations. And just for those people that, you know, didn't study, you know, industrial gases enough in high school, and I was probably more focused on playing basketball than the periodic table back then, but we need industrial gases everywhere. And they go into all sorts of manufacturing, whether it's, you know, healthcare, it's refineries, it's getting oil and gas out of the ground. It's so many things. It's building solar panels. I mean, almost everything is in some way is touched by industrial gases. And these guys have just incredible returns on capital.
Yep.
And we've made well over 10 times in 20 years, just basically buying the stock and staying out of the way. I check in with management once a quarter, but you wake up every day. It is a structurally advantaged business. But in some ways, those can become boring, because at some point, there's not a lot of things to work on because they dominate their market and they're just incrementally putting capital to work. And now that happens to be things like hydrogen and such forth. So that's one area. Is like, you need to build a portfolio of low drama quality compounders, right?
Absolutely.
And so that's the first part. But the second part, and this is what I'd say for readers, if there's a secret sauce that I can share here, again, it's really the long-term secular growth business that has relevancy, where there's innovation that, but also has a bullwhip cycle around it. And I'm just going to talk briefly about semiconductors. Then I'm going to take that into some other industries in an economy of words. So when you think about semiconductors, for example, 25 years ago, huge amount of growth ahead of us. We had the PC wave, handhelds, cloud computing, and now we have AI and big data and autonomous driving, and we're going to electrify the grid, all that. But within that, you know there's growth, but 15 or 20 years ago, we didn't know the next growth driver. So there's always innovation behind, you know, beyond the horizon. And so that is an incredible opportunity for companies that are on the leading edge of innovation to benefit from things that aren't known yet. Because the key thing about making money is we can't just, you know, read the cover of the paper and invest behind that. The big money is behind themes that aren't known yet. And so in semiconductors, when you're bending the laws of physics, when you're putting 100 billion transistors on something the size of your fingernail, when you're depositing 60 miles of wires on something the size of your fingernail and getting down to 1 nanometers, there's magical innovation that happens. So the key thing is find a business where you don't need to be a prophet or a sage, but you know there's more innovation that will be coming because it's structurally advantaged and you have the smartest minds of the world putting capital behind innovation. So that would be semiconductors. And those waves of compute, which will go on, you know, for decades to come, that's a very friendly trend. And the key thing is where you have cycles around inventories and economy and trade. When those trade off, you have fantastic opportunity because when things trade off, they doubt the long term. And when you see people doubting that, that's opportunity. But there's other industries, John, that are absolutely like that. Say life sciences, for example. You have life sciences businesses, say like a company like Danaher, which we've owned for a long time. Danaher is a fantastic business, life sciences. But within life sciences, even though you think about medical research and you've kind of visualized people in white coats and beakers doing research, there's cycles around that. There's IPO cycles, there's raising capital, there's valuations. We had the COVID cycle. So there's another setup there with life sciences where, you know, now we're coming off, you know, a COVID wave that's rolling off. We had an IPO wave in 2021 that's rolling off. We have high rates. We have people cutting R&D budgets. So there's another case where think about personalized medicine, genomics, large molecules, monoclonal antibodies, where you look in the future of medicine, it's unbelievable. But within that, there's still cycles around funding and the economy and NIH budget. So that's where you can find these like exponential industries, but there's short-term dynamics that are helping you get into long-term trends that would be mispriced. And so that's also true for a lot of waves of compute. It's also true in some industries like financial innovation that we're seeing even with banks and how people buy things and like a MasterCard, for example, that continues to grow. So the key thing is, again, find industries where there's innovation and companies that have wide moats around that innovation. And then that's where, you know, the beta and the alpha can really combine because those cycles are your best friend. And I think that's the practitioner's part of it that's so fun, whether it's cloud computing, semiconductors, artificial intelligence, life sciences, exchanges, and even, you know, with precision agriculture and companies like John Deere, right? They're going to, we've talked a lot about they can transform the way farming and it's going to go from a tractor company to a software company, to an autonomous driving tractor company. And we've talked about Deere for many, many years in the past. So that's where, as an investor, you can have a whole lot of fun and find some opportunity.
That was so awesome, Todd. Like you, I also cover semiconductors and Lindy. And I don't know if I talk to Lindy every quarter like you do, but I do speak to Juan Paliez, the head of IR there, quite frequently. And it is just such a wonderful business. When you have that CapEx locked in right over the fence, piped in right over the fence, for 10 years, you know, take or pay contracts. It's a pretty amazing business. So you just talked in depth and in beautiful prose about what you look for in a good business. What about a good stock? And then maybe related to that, can you share, you know, maybe a few portfolio level metrics with us, like maybe the average return on equity or the average PE ratio of your portfolio?
That's such a good point. So you have a good company, good stock, right? We're in the business of obviously compounding people's money. So that means good stocks, but they all have to be good businesses. So when you think about it for us, John, there's two things that we boil down to, and I'm having a cup of coffee and looking at the eye of one of my analysts, is that it's the narrative and the math. And there's one thing, I'm a storyteller. I like telling stocks and stories. And that's really the narrative of when you start talking in stories, what's a magical thing starts to happen, John, that the shelf life of the information starts to all of a sudden, your 2020 vision goes out, right? Like, we don't tell great stories about something that's only going to happen for 1 or 2 days, right? Great stories are 1, 3, 5, 10 year stories. So the narrative is the story, right? Where are they deploying capital? How are they innovating? Who's in management? What's the business model? And how do they keep building the long-term relevancy? Because what's so cool is talking about the future, right? So that's the narrative. And narratives are awesome, but you can also get swept up in stories, right? You can get over-caffeinated in the story. So that's where the magic comes to the narrative and into the math. So the narrative only takes you so far. It has to go to the math. And so for us, like, really a sweet spot is, you know, we'll pay, you know, 25 times earnings doesn't really faze me. If there's a lot of, growth ahead, we've at times paid a bit more, but when you think about, you have to then underwrite to returns. And so for us, we look out 3 years and we look at what are the margins, the revenues, earnings, and multiple today. So I said 3 or 4 things, keep it super simple. And then we look out to make a, say, 8 to 20% return, which is kind of our starting point. What margins, revenue, growth, and exit multiple do we need in 3 years to make those returns? So in end, it's kind of looking at what forward multiple, what are the earnings, what are the revenues, what are the margins now and 3 years from now? And then we plug in returns and we start to say, how does that fit with the narrative? So we equally, we need the math and the narrative to work. And so that's the thing where when I talk to my team, I love stories, but at some point we have to connect them to the numbers, right?
Right.
And so I think that's the essence of what we do. And then finally around that, what's the sentiment on the stock, right? And so narrative can be, what's the narrative around the business? What's the story? But then narrative's also like, do people love or hate the stock on Wall Street, right? So the narrative is multidimensional, John. Narrative of the business. And then how appreciated is this story? And then how do those align? And then how does the math look, right? And I think that's where it's easier said than done. It's easy to say that. But the key thing is you have to be really good at connecting a story to the math, to the narrative, to the sentiment, to underwriting the returns. And each one of those steps, you hope you add alpha in each step, right? Like, where are we getting alpha in this narrative conversation? Where are we getting alpha in the numbers conversation? And then where's the sentiment? You know, Howard Marks has been a hero for years. Things overshoot. So it's kind of with a lens of that. And then ultimately, like, what return does it underwrite to on math and margin? So that's the fun part of it. And that's why, we feel that, it takes some time to do this, but it gets down, again, to temperament and shelf life of information, because great narratives are not like 1 week stories, right?
I agree. And I also think that connecting the narrative and the numbers and weaving the narrative into my estimates looking out 3 to 5 years is also fun, like you just described it. I don't know if a lot of people would describe that as fun, but it's definitely fun to you and I. What is your portfolio management philosophy in the Core Equity Fund? How many stocks do you own? What is your average sort of starter position size? What is your average full position size? And then anything else you want to discuss around portfolio management?
Yeah, because in the end, you can talk stocks, but you got to put a winning portfolio together. So we're high conviction, John. As you know, we have 40 stocks. The top 10 holdings are typically over, 40% or more of the portfolio. Our largest holdings will go up to 7%. We've had, Microsoft as high as 7 at times. And we don't enter a position unless it's 1%. So, okay. We're not going to do starter positions or watch positions. Those are distracting. And so the key thing about, portfolio construction is we're very bottoms up on that in a lot of ways, where we want a high slugging percentage and, high conviction, high active share. As you know, we're at a very concentrated benchmark. Yes. We want to look different than the S&P. So we have active share that runs, 75% or so, which is essentially our portfolio looks, different than the S&P 500. But the key thing about portfolio construction in this world, John, is that it's one thing to own your biggest ideas, but you also have to have a mind on risk. And so we do look at some quantitative, like what factors are we overweight or underweight to? Because one thing about, you know, portfolio management is you want to find the alpha, but you got to be thoughtful of like under what conditions will a stock work, right? Because Lindy is going to work different than NVIDIA, which will work different than John Deere, which will, you know, work different than, you know, Danaher. And so for us is we're also looking at, you know, what cycles are we betting on within the portfolio and what market conditions are we looking at? We do look at macro trends. So ultimately, when we look at our portfolio, for example, you know, you hear a lot about the Magnificent Seven, and we're underweight the Mag Seven because clearly, you know, we look for alpha, we look for active share, we're looking for our own idiosyncratic stories for sure. But the key question is like, if the Mag 7 keeps running, how does a core equity fund keep up with that? Or what's your strategy? So for instance, a year ago, we had a, you know, we still have today a large bet on software companies. So we don't own Amazon, we don't own Meta, we don't own Tesla, right? But for us, the portfolio construction was, we're going to have huge positions in Salesforce because we think, you know, Salesforce margins look like they have a lot of room to run higher, top line more durable, they can benefit from AI and cloud. And they're now getting more evangelical about margins going up and they have pricing power. So all the, you know, moat, relevancy, management, long-term trend, beautiful. So we own a major position in Salesforce. It's one of our largest holdings because in some ways we are looking at the benchmark and saying that's offsetting Mag 7. And we own, you know, things like Oracle that we think are cheap valuations. Microsoft, we are going to like look at the benchmark, but we're going to find that active share and then size positions, say like a John Deere. John Deere is a remarkable stock because it gives you more features. And it's almost like sometimes stocks are almost like driving a car where you get in there, oh, there's a great sound system and there's air conditioning and there's four-wheel drive and the car is super fast. But you think about John Deere, it's not only a tractor company, it's an ag company, but they also benefit, say if oil prices go up this year, they have ethanol to corn goes up. So there's a lot of different, what factors, what markets would John Deere work, right? So when I'm putting a portfolio together of sizing, I like to think of, is there only one reason why the stock can go up? Let's just say it's a pharma company that has one clinical trial. All your chips are on the center of the table on that one factor. So that would dictate how large do I size it. But then there's other stocks, say like, you know, like a John Deere that can work in multiple markets, or a company like CME, which is benefiting on like volatility and interest rates. What types of, so the key thing is there's returns, there's math, there's narrative, but ultimately in portfolio construction, John, it gets down to like what factors will make that stock go up? Or in other words, what factors does this company have that would be appreciated in different market regimes? And the more that you can check on that, the larger the position. So you could have two stocks that have the same return stream, but if one of them can work in four or five regimes and one works in one, you're going to size the one that's got 15 and more regimes, right? So that's another factor. I don't think a lot of investors think through. They're more like, I look at earnings, I look at the return. Yes, important, but like what market regimes will that stock outperform in? And again, the more you can check the box in, you're going to size not all 15% returns are the same return stream that are going to be the same size. And I think people get that wrong quite a bit.
I love how you create this mosaic of not only the fundamentals and the expected return from the stock, but also you're looking at the flows, you're looking at the factors, you're looking at some macro drivers, and the more boxes you can check, you know, the higher likelihood you'll make it a larger position. So this is a show on investing process. So I'd like to dive deep into the process at Parnassus with these next several questions, Todd. So to begin, how many people are on the investing team and are the analysts generalists or specialists?
Right. So we're blessed to have a deep team. We have 25 people on the team. 19 of those are either, you know, analysts or portfolio managers. And they're basically set in their coverage around sectors. We have five different sector teams, and those are consumer, cyclicals, financials, tech, and healthcare. So basically, we have five sector teams. And within those different sectors, there's roughly like 25 different little GICS components. So say our comm services rolls up through consumer because comm services flows up that way. Or in our cyclicals, we have energy, materials, industrials, right? So within those five, there's little 25 subsectors all fit in. Those 19 individuals are all, you know, spread out across, you know, sector teams. And so the average analyst covers somewhere between 10 and 20 stocks for us. So we don't want to overtax them. They'll sit on a couple sector teams. And so really it's about deep research. Those teams meet once a month. We have a sector head leader who's a senior analyst that really helps kind of quarterback what we're looking at. That could be existing holdings, things on the pipeline, watch lists, sectors. So, you know, meet once a month, quarterback by a sector team. All the strategies that we have, and we have five equity strategies, they have a PM present in every sector team. Mm-hmm. So we're really trying to cover the surface area looking for the alpha generation in those.
You are definitely blessed to have such a deep team, 19 analysts and portfolio managers. What does the team's research process look like, and what has to happen for a new name to get into the portfolio? Like, you know, so does an analyst just go off on his own or her own, research a stock in their sector, and then pitch it to the team? And then what are the follow-up steps after that? What does it look like?
Perfect. So about one third of the ideas over the years have come from PMs identifying a name to work on, and okay, roughly two thirds have come from the analysts. So let's just talk about what happens there. So if you're on a sector team and you're an analyst, you know, you're covering, you know, 10 to 15 stocks, and then you're probably looking at pitching about or digging into about another 10 stocks a year. What you would do is you would look at your sector. Say you're like a healthcare analyst and you're like, hey, life sciences have sold off, and here's a name I want to look at. You're going to look at that name, and you're going to go into your sector team meeting, and you're going to make a quick pitch about like, hey, here's an idea I have. Here's the narrative. Here's the math. Here's the opportunity. And I think here are the funds that this stock's appropriate for. And you make that pitch in a sector team. And then, as you know, there's PMs in that sector team meeting, and they basically need to sponsor the idea. So you need to get at least one PM to say like, I agree with you that that's a good idea. And then what we do is we then put that into a deep dive, and it goes into a deep dive where that analyst will really go and do some extensive work. It can take as short as a couple weeks. If we've owned the stock before, we owned it recently, or we have a lot of expertise, it can be a relatively short process. If we haven't invested in that business or that subsector, or we're not as familiar, it can take a month or several months. So that analyst then will ultimately do a deep dive. In that deep dive, they end up writing an investment summary. And that investment summary is really the ultimate pitch, John, where they're digging into, you know, what is the business? What are the systemic factors that we like about the stock in terms of the secular themes of the industry? What are the idiosyncratic bets we making? So it's like, again, systemic factors, think, you know, relevancy. Idiosyncratic factors would be like, hey, we see margins going up or new product cycle. So that's getting into the alpha part of it. And then we do a deep dive of like moat, relevancy, management, governance, environmental health and safety, key bear thesis, and then key things to follow up on. And that's a couple page note with like ultimately a model and underwriting to returns. And so that's where the rubber hits the road when they present that in a deep dive setting of like, here's my idea, here's the numbers, here's the math, here's the story. And there's a repeatable process that every investment summary has the same template. Again, systemic factors, idiosyncratic, looking at the moat, relevancy, management, governance, key drivers, environmental health, safety. So we're all speaking the same language so we can evaluate the returns. And then some of those are bought, some aren't. And again, we're kind of asking them to, you know, think about finding, you look at 10 to 15 new investment candidates each year. Do we buy all of them? We don't. And then they also cover their 10 to 20 stocks.
Love that. And then just to follow up, how much leeway do the analysts have to find these names on their own versus a portfolio manager saying, hey, can you go research this name for me?
Well, that's great, because it's really two-thirds, like I said, two-thirds, okay, one-third. But let me just tell you, there is leeway, because in the end, we seek to hire people that they're creative. They have a lot of curiosity. They're looking for new things. And, you know, I love a growth mentality, a growth mindset. So I want people to look Look at things we haven't owned. Look at what's moving, what's underperforming. So the key thing is analysts are highly encouraged to also look for their own ideas, because in short, when you think about your progression in this business, it's been said by others, but there's the basic part is information. Information turns to knowledge, knowledge, wisdom. Then there's experiential knowledge and wisdom. Then there's like looking around corners. And that's a journey that we're all on. I've been on it for 29 years and, you know, maybe even another 29, we'll see. But the key thing about it is you don't go on that journey to look around corners if you're just being told what to look for. Yeah. Yeah. So we highly encourage people to look and find ideas, because I think if you find something, that's what you're gonna be most passionate about. And so it's definitely encouraged.
And for the two-thirds part of it that they're just going out and finding their own ideas, what does that idea generation process look like? How typically are the analysts on your team sourcing new ideas, and how do you narrow down your investing universe? You know, are they looking at stocks that have gotten beaten down recently? How does an idea get onto their radar?
Yeah. So if you're on a sector team, clearly every month or every day, you're looking at what's underperforming, what's outperforming, what do we own, what factors do portfolio manager, are we already long or short, right? Mm-hmm. So they got to know intimately what funds are long and are not overweight certain dynamics in a sector. The second thing is then they're clearly keeping up on the day-to-day information. Like right now we have the JP Morgan Healthcare Conference going on. Like what's coming out of that? Anything new? Anything that we should be taking a look at? So we're expecting people to stay up on industry conferences, earnings season, contacts in the industry, reading, could be an awesome podcast. You know, we want people to have an intellectual curiosity around all those areas where you can have a slugging percentage. And then in that, find opportunities that then could maybe fit into our process, or do we want to double down on existing exposure? Or boy, you get a notice from a PM, like I'm really underweight cyclicals right now. And it feels like the Fed may pivot. So then that analyst is like, I'm really looking for cyclicals for you. So
yes,
you have to communicate. And that's one of the key things that I try to set. There's introverts and extroverts and, God bless them all. But my thing is my personality is like, you really got to touch and talk to people. Like, what are the PMs looking for? What should you be focusing your attention? Because the key thing is there's a balance, Sean, between looking for new ideas and then wasted effort. And nothing's ever wasted, but if you're just spending months and months and not finding something, then maybe you're wasting some effort. And so that's the key thing about our process of these monthly sector team meetings. If you're presenting an idea, there's no interest, or if you're not coming up with new things, it's almost like that accountability, right? Like, mm-hmm. Hey, a month's gone by and I didn't find anything. That's fine. But if 3 months go by, is it something about your process?
Sure.
So we all work together to try to, again, conferences, earnings season, contacts, reading publications, Wall Street Journal, everything that between, that's a contact point, just having that creativity, imagination, desire to look, motivation, that's where we find our best ideas.
Yeah, Todd. And hearing you today and then getting to know you over the past several years, you really embody, as a CIO and portfolio manager, you really embody this idea of communication. Like you said at the beginning of this, you only have typically about an hour of screen time a day. Rather than, just sitting behind your computer, you are having coffee meetings, sitting by the water cooler and talking to your analysts at their desk, whatever it is. And so it's a very iterative and communicative process that you seem to be leading at Parnassus. And that's something that I've learned from you over the years that I have a high degree of respect for. Sticking on this idea of communication, let's say an analyst wants to pitch something to you. He or she is in an elevator with you, 2 minutes. What would you like that analyst to communicate to you in a short elevator pitch on a stock?
Yeah, it's really going to sound the narrative and math. I want to know the story about 3 to 5 to 10 years from now. What's the trend that we're betting on that could really unlock value for the company? And how are they innovating into it? Because I want companies that are truly providing unique value to some sort of relevancy in the economy. So I want to know 3 to 5 years, 10 years out, what's the relevancy story? Where's the industry? What are these guys doing different? Or in other words, like, what problem is this company solving?
Yes.
That very few people in the world can solve. Like, I like Applied Materials. Two people in the world can do it, and this industry could go exponential. I'm like, yes. Number two is, how much are we paying for it? And then how long is it take to double my money, right? 7, 5 years, 3 years. So do they fundamentally do something really hard to do? How many people in the world can do it? What's the multiple in the stock, and how long can I double my money? And then finally, does management know what they're doing? Where are they putting capital behind it? And then we're exiting on the 16th floor, and then we're off. So, right.
Excellent. So as chief investment officer, how much time do you spend thinking about the macro backdrop, and what is your current macro outlook? If you have a strong conviction on a current macro outlook.
You know, this is an interesting point that I think a lot of bottoms up investors, there's almost like a purity that says, like, I'm bottoms up, I don't think about macro. And it's almost like that's what you need to say to be a true bottoms up investor. I actually spend probably a third of my time thinking about macro trends, and two thirds are bottoms up. And here's the thing, is because I like to see, where's capital getting deployed in the economy? Where's liquidity, monetary policy, interest rates, trends, trade wars? There's a lot of things that are melding out there. And the more I can do to understand some of those trends, I can appreciate how to double down on the stock specific stuff, right? Yep. And I think that's one of the keys, is that, central banks are way more important than they were when I first started, central bank balance sheets, liquidity. And so for me, is what I'm not going to be a prophet on predicting GDP this year, but here's what I'll summarize for you, John. I want to know where the inflection points are.
Yeah.
And so right now I think we're in an inflection point where I think rates have peaked, and the next regime is, we're going from higher rates, low liquidity, to 12 months from now, lower rates, higher liquidity. That is a positive backdrop. So I want to at least be informed on that dynamic. I think we are entering this year, as we've posted on our website, on my thoughts of, lower growth, and things look like an adult swim is what our title is in our CIO piece. But I think we exit this year that, we've kind of in a better position from liquidity. And I think probably prospects look better after, 2024 into 2025. So that backdrop gives me the confidence then to work backwards on, are these earnings estimates realistic? Because if you don't have a view on the economy, how do you know if the earnings estimates are realistic, right? So
absolutely,
I think they cycle through. So when I look at the markets this year, we feel that the market still sets up for pretty good returns, that the S&P 500 is 5225, which is 19 times forward estimates of $270 a share. And so that's about a 12% return. And so we think inflation's coming off. We think, the 10-year treasury can trend towards, maybe 3% by the end of the year. And so we think there's going to be some upside to equities. It'll be a bumpy year. We may have a recession. That's not necessarily a base case, but there could be one. But I think it would be met with more liquidity. So I think the backdrop and the markets are pretty positive going into the year with this regime of monetary policy ahead of us.
Very clearly stated. Thank you for that. And how do you communicate this macro outlook to the team? I mean, I know you said you published your piece, which I read, the Adult Swim piece. I think I actually posted about it on X, but it was a great piece. But how do you communicate your macro outlook to the team? Is this an email you send out, or are you having a formal macro meeting every once in a while?
Yeah, so once a quarter, I sit down and have something kind of written up more formally, mm-hmm. that goes internally to our team, and obviously our sales and marketing and client team needs to be aware of that. So really, once a quarter, we have a, pretty, intentional communication. Now, obviously, macro dynamics can change in between. And in that case, we have a monthly meeting, which I have as it's a CIO PM meeting. And so in that, all the PMs get into a room and the team gets in, and we all go around the horn. We talk about our positioning for each one of our five equity strategies and our fixed income fund. So if there's something that needs to be said, there's a monthly cadence as well. So what I don't want to do is have weekly meetings, because what, you know, some firms have a morning call, you know, God bless them, John, but then you start over extrapolating noise. It's what, sure, I don't want to do is be every Tuesday I'm putting on a headset and I'm coming down from a mountain with some tablets and proclaiming how the world looks. That's not the point. But like once a month's a really good kind of like, hey, let's check in. What do you see? And I'll share that. But once a quarter is a really good cadence to update people on views.
Another common theme that I'm pulling from this discussion with you, Todd, today, which is just incredible, is this idea that you try to eliminate or minimize noise and distractions. So earlier in our talk today, you said, you know, you don't take tiny starter positions, you don't take tiny watch lists or research positions, because you said that's just a distraction. And now you're saying you're not going to have a morning call, you're not going to have a weekly meeting, because then you're almost forcing information, new information that may not be there, and it just becomes noise or a distraction. So that's another theme that I'm taking from this, which is just incredible. Talk to us about valuation. So I know you said you're doing, you know, 3-year estimates of earnings per share, or free cash flow per share 3 years out. You're looking at that 3-year out PE. Anything else you want to mention about how your team thinks about valuation and different valuation tools that you're using?
Right. So again, we look out 3 years and underwrite to returns. And so part of valuation is what's the starting multiple? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we typically don't buy a lot of stocks that are trading above 25 times, but if it's got an exceptional moat, exceptional relevancy, or maybe earnings are depressed for some reason, you know, we'll go above that. But really the first thing is like justifying the current multiple versus the S&P.
Yes.
And so if you think about, you know, the S&P trading at 20 times and you're paying 25 times, you'd want to look at clearly what sort of a premium is the stock trading at versus the S&P today? And then what does that premium look like over the last 3, 5, 10 years? And I think for us, this is where it becomes fun that, John, you want to look at like, you know, how is the premium changing? Does it deserve to trade at more of a premium, right? Because the goal here to make some money is like, you want all your stocks to trade at a premium to the S&P. That means you made people money and hopefully continue to. But for us, the key thing is looking at the moat, relevancy, management, how they're deploying capital, pricing power, resiliency, and building the case of the starting multiple. Then the key is the ending multiple of like, why can a stock have multiple expansion over 3 years? Because that's where the real money is made, is not just the E going up, but the P going up.
Yep.
And so that's the key tactician, is not only are earnings estimates reasonable today and where are they out 3 years, and then building the case for why is the current multiple justified? And then how is that a premium or a discount to the past? And then forward looking, maybe looking around corners to peak of why can that discount narrow or that premium widen? And that's the real source of like, we've owned Costco for years and years. And, you know, God bless Costco. It's been a titan, but they just compound money. They print money and look at the multiple.
Yeah.
And so you could have gotten shaken out of the stock years ago because it got elevated, but like just time and time again, they're best in world. And so that builds, again, I don't want your listeners to miss narrative and math. The narrative sources the math. And that is really the key of like a Costco, where that narrative and that story has caused the premium to widen over the years. And don't, you know, miss that, because that's how you really compound, or a Praxair or Lindy. So they're all connected. They're all interrelated. It's almost like biology working together. And so for us, it's starting multiple, but it's about that premium widening or a discount narrowing, or a discount going to a premium, which is like the holy grail.
Yeah. And I love that best in world comment. I'm gonna have to use that one. Starting multiple, but you know, you stress that you're looking at sort of a normalized earnings. You know, you said, are current expectations for earnings reasonable? And you also said you want to make sure that earnings aren't depressed. And so you're looking at the denominator from some sort of normalized point of view.
It is. Totally, John. Just a point on that. Like, I know there's a lot of great bottoms-up investors, but at least for us, we want to be aware of what's the consensus. So this year, people are looking for like 1.2% GDP growth. Mm-hmm. Does that actually foot with the numbers we're starting with? So we want to make sure we're building the right case that we're hopefully not totally far off on the earnings. And then 3 years out, what are the drivers of margins and revenues and growth? And then obviously solving for the multiple is really important in that.
Yeah. Talk to us about selling, Todd. Under what circumstances do you trim a position? And then under what circumstances do you sell out completely?
Yeah. So as you know, people talk a lot about when you get the fundamentals wrong, you sell, and we're no different on that. I think on the return stream, we talked about underwriting to stocks at 8 to 20% returns.
Yep.
And so when all of a sudden we look out 3 years and a stock is just not underwriting to at least 8%, if the stock's moved up or earnings are not moving in the right direction, or we think the multiple doesn't deserve the premium it has or should trade more of a discount, the minute it triggers below 8, then that is obviously a candidate to sell. Unless you're looking at, say, like a Procter & Gamble, for example, where like it underwrites to 6 to 8 and you want it for defensive characteristics, right? So you're still building a portfolio. So you could be saying, I like Mondelez and I like P&G and they're kind of 6 to 8% returns. And we want that exposure to give us some defensive characteristics. So unless something's really giving you some very unique characteristics that you value, you're like, that would be a sell as well. The second thing that comes down to sells that I think some people miss is that sometimes sells are just portfolio construction. And I'm just going to state this simply that you could have two stocks that have 15% returns and you trim one and buy the other. And you're like, Todd, what in the heck are you doing? Why are you doing that? It's because you're putting a portfolio together and you fundamentally value the factors that could drive this 15% more than the other 15%. And I think that's something that's missed. So in essence, when you think about, a company like Salesforce that we really stacked up a lot of chips on last year, what we saw in Salesforce was a margin story, a growth story, an earnings resilient story that, you don't kick out Salesforce if the economy downturns. And so we started to appreciate with that stock was that we had other stocks that underwrote to some similar returns, but we're like, okay, Salesforce gives us some portfolio insurance to the Mag 7. If there's a massive growth rally, Salesforce gives us help. If the economy slows down, well, geez, people don't rip out Salesforce. Could there actually be some defensive characteristics to this business? Yes, yes, yes. And the more checks you have, I was actually selling some stocks with similar return profiles, but those stocks would work under a more narrow market regime, right? Yep. So that happens a lot where we're constantly looking, what's our return stream? Clearly margins, revenues, growth, but we're going to sell stocks at times when, again, they work under a more narrow market regime, right? And so we really value that. I think some portfolio managers can miss that.
I agree. There's different skill sets in analysis and portfolio management, and constructing that final portfolio, that final body of work, is really the art of it. I think is putting all the pieces together to deliver, good risk adjusted return potential. And I love how you connect everything back to the portfolio. And so maybe for one of my last questions, one of the things I respect most about the Parnassus Core Equity Fund is a 40 stock fund, and you don't go over that usually. And so to add something to the fund, you have to remove something. And I love that discipline, Todd. I love that discipline. It's all about opportunity cost. You're looking for your 40 best ideas constructed into a portfolio. So my question is, what do you gravitate towards selling in order to fund a new position? Are you typically selling something in the same sector as the new idea that you want to add?
That is such a great question. I wish we had more time, John. That's getting into the meat of it a lot.
It is, yeah.
Let me think about how to answer that in a practitioner's way. We often don't buy and sell stocks in the same sector because at some point there's correlation of what's the point. You're doing portfolio churn, sometimes raising taxes. And so that's not typically where my mind space is just to trade two semiconductor stocks, right? Okay. Like, because that's, to me, not as productive. I'm typically appreciating not only a stock, but I want more exposure to some thematic aspect of the economy.
Yes.
And so I'm not looking to just trade two pharma stocks or two semi stocks or two life sciences stocks. So for me, it's about an analyst coming with an idea and I'm like, I like the narrative. I like the math. What factors does that give us to? And how does this fundamentally, John, make the portfolio better? Okay.
Yes.
I mean, that has to be your mindset every single day. So, you know, selling one large cap pharma to buy another, you start to pretty quickly squint. Is this making a real difference? But if you say you're selling a pharmaceutical stock and, you know, buying a semiconductor stock, now we're talking about a difference, okay? Now we're talking about, is this a needle moving trade or is this yes. noise on my desk? Because like, I think in my world, I make about 12 to 14 big decisions a year. And kind of summing up this whole call, it's like, if you're only going to have to make 12 to 14 big decisions a year, what do you want in your headspace to make those? I don't want a lot of noise. I don't want a lot of distraction. I don't want stress. I don't want anxiety. I don't want fear. I don't want short shelf life information. Mm-hmm. So trading assets in one sector, is that really going to be it for us? Or is it going to be a new theme that is really going to make this portfolio better? Again, what factors, what dynamics of the economy is this covering in the portfolio? How does it make it better? How does it change the exposures we have? So that's the key, is to eliminating the noise. And if we're just going to trade stocks within a sector, you know, part of it is, you know, why did we get this wrong in the first place? Like, what's changed? Like, why are we doing this now? So anyways, it's typically different stocks, different sectors, and it's about conviction, and it's about doubling down on your best ideas. And that's the essence of it.
And making the portfolio better, as you said. And yeah, Todd, I just, once again, I love how you have created this process and this structure and this framework and this mindset of minimizing the noise, minimizing the distractions, minimizing the stress, minimizing the anxiety, and minimizing the short shelf life information. To me, go ahead.
Exactly. I'll say a final thing, because this is a really good point. Like, we try to think about, say, like having like, say, 30% turnover in a year. Mm-hmm. So if you think about this, you have a 30% turnover budget and you're an analyst on the team, you only have so many punch cards, John, that you're going to come into the office and say, hey, Todd, I want to sell 2% of this and buy 2% of that, right?
Yes.
So it's going to raise your game. Now, if I'm just trading every day, you're like, I'm going to go to Todd's office. He's had two cups of coffee. He's ready to roll. That's not the point. The point is, like, you only have a couple punch cards. And are you going to put, I mean, this is, you know, more extreme, but are you going to put your entire bonus on the table right now
sure.
to make this trade or not?
Yeah.
Yes or no. That's not how we compensate. So I don't want people, but that's like, you have to have a little bit of that mentality. And I'll almost like joke about that a bit. I'm like, would you put your entire bonus, we're going to stack the bills up on this mm-hmm. trade or not? Because I don't want the noise. And I think there has to be a barrier to make a trade, because people trade too much. And all the great ones will tell you that, including, you know, humbly, I've traded too much over the years. So set a bar, have a turnover budget, have portfolio hygiene, but the quality of the conversations go up, the original thought goes up. And that's where I think the alpha can come in. But you have to raise the bar, because we only make so many good decisions, or we only have so many big decisions a year. And you've got to raise the bar on those.
I almost don't want to ask this next question. The question being, what's, you know, you've been doing this for 29 years. You've worked your way up to one of the most high profile investors in the country. You know, you're a member of the Barron's Roundtable. You've had an incredible, run and performance record. The question's, what's one of the biggest investing lessons you've learned over the years? I almost don't want to ask it, because you've already shared so many, you know, whether it's avoid distractions and noise, whether it's don't trade too much, whether it's portfolio hygiene, whether it's don't interrupt a compounder like a Costco. You've shared so many lessons already with us today, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So is there any other big investing lesson you've learned over the last 29 years that you'd like to share with us?
Oh, totally. I'll just, you know, one that's top of mind for me is that some people think of this business as like a mathematical IQ test of like, I want to buy the stock right at the bottom and they put price targets. It's okay, John. It's okay to miss the first 20 or 30 or 40% of a stock's move out of a cycle. It's okay because if you get that more exponential theme right, stocks can still 3 to 5 to 10x. And just for me, I've looked back over the 29 years I've been doing this, and you have your logarithmic charts, but there's certain times I'm like, I thought I missed it. And then it like 5x'd after that the next 10 years. So the key thing is if you're right, right? And you're like, oh, I missed it. You haven't missed it. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think we say that way too much. I'm sure people on the show are like, oh, I thought I had it. I missed the move. No, you probably didn't if you're right on the secular relevancy theme, right? And that's the key thing is that just because a stock's moved on you, it doesn't mean you've missed it. And short-term blips are short-term blips. And always think about the next 3 to 5 to 10 years because great stocks are great compounders. And the second thing I'll say, I'll give you a bonus ball. It's like Larry Bird hitting three-pointers on the – it's –
Thank you.
When people, John, when they look at too many times in a meeting here, I'll hear, I like the stock, but I'm waiting for valuation.
Right.
And I think if I put a list of tickers on a whiteboard right now and said, here's 30 of them that we waited on valuation, probably 70% of those worked.
Wow.
So when you're saying that, I like it. Are you saying then that this stock's going to go down, but the market's going to not go down too? Or what are you saying? Like if you're saying it's valuation, like why is this stock that you like the fundamentals on going to go down, but the market's not? Like, tell me what you're saying here. What's going to unlock the opportunity? And so for me, if you like a business within the realm of reason, if the valuation's reasonable, at least buy half the position, which for us would be like, say, 1.5%, and then double down. Because you should always have the mindset, I'm buying more if it goes down, right?
Yeah.
And so that's something else. So it's you didn't miss it on the first 20 or 30%. And if you're saying, I love it, but I don't like the valuation, like probably buy those and then double down if it goes down and then, you know, chill out. You know, so that would be the whole thing. So
two great lessons from a great practitioner. Last question, Todd. So we dove deep into the Parnassus investing process today, into your process as a chief investment officer and portfolio manager, into your mindset, which I really, really appreciate. Is there anything that we missed or anything else I should have asked you that I didn't regarding Parnassus or its process or how your team is structured?
You know, I think Parnassus is a great firm, like I said, from our founding with Jerry in 1984. And we're really just practitioners with the markets. And like I said, I think in this world, there's a lot of passive flows. There's a lot of short-term pod shops. I think we're going into an era now where, you know, real interest rates will be a little bit higher. Due to, you know, some structural deficits in the economy and such forth, and that I feel like we're going into a golden age of active management. And I think our high conviction kind of long-term compounder secular themes wide moat is perfect for this environment. And I hearken back, I'll start this when I was 22 years old. Again, no internet, no cell phone, but there was some really good sell side research out there. And there was, you know, Stars and different firms. And I think now, there's just not the same type of research with the same type of shelf life as the market's gone more passive. And I think that's going to be a tremendous opportunity for companies. A lot of your guests on the show who are really digging in. I think high quality research is lacking these days. And there's a lot of market factors and passive flows. And those things are making, you know, true idiosyncratic research a rare breed. Just there aren't as many. I mean, I was blessed to be 22 years old to have a founder, and I was just driving down the Silicon Valley in my old car, just talking to CFOs. There's just not as many people doing that anymore.
Yeah.
It's more quantitative. So I think that's going to be really valuable over the next decade that, you know, as a practitioner, high active share, just doing the work, talking to people, finding opportunities, having a defined process, it could be a really golden era for stock pickers.
There you have it, folks. We have a lack of high quality, really rigorous, idiosyncratic research. And Todd thinks it could be a golden era for active management with high active share. Todd, This has been one of my most favorite conversations on investing I think I have ever had. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, good luck, everybody, in 2024 and beyond. And it's been an honor to be here, John. I love your work and look forward to more of your podcasts in the future.
I appreciate that, Todd. Thank you. And before we sign off, I'd like to provide a quick reminder. Anything discussed on the J. Rowe Show by myself or my guest is solely our own opinions and does not constitute formal advice or a recommendation. The J. Rowe Show is for entertainment purposes only, so please do your own research on any securities discussed on this podcast. Thank you for tuning in, and we will see you next time.